Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning, and thanks for being with me this morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Proverbs 10:8 says, "The wise in heart accept commands, but a chattering fool comes to ruin." I got to work on that one. So, how about this? When you realize you're lost, and you're driving around in your car, and you go, "Okay, now I'm lost," and I turn my radio down for some reason. I think that's going to help me get less lost. I don't know why I do that. I'm trying to increase my senses, or I'm going, if I can think better. But if you can think better, shouldn't the radio be always a little softer then? I don't know. I'm trying to figure stuff out. Great to have you with me this morning. I've got Dr. Peter Capster already in studio, and we're going to discuss many things. I just read millennials are blaming baby boomers for ruining their lives. I'm pretty sure that goes both ways. But you never know, do you? All right. After Peter Capster, John Bloom's going to come in. We have the McArnold Group, and you know that's a Fast and Furious show. Three misfits in a studio, all yelling at each other. It'll be great. All right. Take a short break and be back with Peter Capster. Really funny. Anyway, Dr. Peter Capster's in studio. It's 7 minutes after the hour. Thanks for being with me. All right, Peter. Elon Musk said that he's going to build a cyborg dragon. Does this guy beat me to the punch on everything?
I love Elon Musk. Well,
the name.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he wants to build these superpowered, you know, underground stations with trains going at 400 miles an hour. He wants to get to the moon. I have not heard about this cyborg dragon deal.
Well, that's just an aside. Who knows?
Right.
But, you know, why not build a cyborg dragon?
Yeah, I mean, the last time I wanted to do that was I was like 12 with
right.
a Lego kit. And he can actually do it.
He can actually carry it out.
It's amazing.
All right. How about the dating professor? This guy got this moniker because his deal is he wants to give extra credit to students if they actually go on a date where they call someone or confront them face to face, ask them out on a date, take them out on a date, and then there's no physical contact, just a date. What do you think? Bad idea? Weird idea?
Well, when I saw the headline, and it's actually it's Kelly Cronin is her name.
Okay.
out of Boston College. But she apparently is a philosophy professor over there. And I will admit, when I saw that headline, I just about dropped my coffee. I couldn't believe that you could actually get away these days with offering extra credit for students in a class to go out on a date. I thought, what kind of assignment actually is that? And then I started reading the article and got a little bit more intrigued. And what she has suggested is that she's inviting students to consider what a good life actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And she's framing it in the context of what Aristotle or Socrates or some of these philosophers of the past would have suggested was a good life. And we're starting to lose that in our culture, especially because of technology. And then it was dating in particular that she began to invite students to. She noticed at Boston College that it was quite a hookup culture that was going on, where students on the weekends didn't even really know each other. And they were blowing past all kinds of boundaries with each other on the weekend, and they would never maybe speak to each other again. And she began to suggest that it's actually now countercultural to go out on dates. And in the sense that, because I think about it as a professor, Bill, that I give assignments where I assume the students don't have prior background knowledge, thus the reason for the assignment. They need to go do the assignment so that they can learn and grow in that area. So you think about what that says, that she's assigning students to go out on a 90-minute date.
Mm-hmm.
They have to stay sober. They have to ask their date out in person. There can't be any physical contact of any kind. And then they report back in on that. And she's noting that students really have no idea anymore how to do that kind of work. And so it's they end up reflecting on what it means to go out on a date, what it means to feel the fear of rejection that they otherwise don't feel in online environments. And I think the thing that stuck out to me most then in this entire story was that students regularly report how much more vulnerable and intimate it feels to have to go ask somebody out on a date than what they were previously doing on a weekend, which was just blowing past all kinds of boundaries with somebody they might not know. It was a fascinating experiment to see.
Did you have a discussion with your students about this?
We haven't had a chance to get to it in class yet, but we absolutely will. We cover so much of that kind of topic relative to why do we feel such freedom to just blow past these boundaries in the way that we do. What's instigating that? What's underneath all of that? So this will be a really important conversation. I may even be willing to try the extra credit of that for our students if needed. It's it's a little different at Northwestern, obviously. It's a different social environment, thankfully, in the sense that this isn't happening anywhere near to the degree that it happens at secular universities. But it's a real important conversation.
What would your conversation be like if you had it with your 18-year-old son?
Yeah, that's the deal, right?
I'm just curious. I remember, you know, when we were in high school, you actually had to make plans. And you made them on the telephone that was in the kitchen or made it on the telephone that was in the family room, and everyone heard your conversation.
Oh, yeah. So, and I would get to that last digit, right, when I would finally call like up Hallie for a date and think, can I press this last digit?
Right.
And then if it would ring, I was pretty liable to hang up at that moment.
Yeah, of course you
And
were.
If she actually answered, I'd hang up, and now I'm kind of creepy about it. You finally have to do that just sort of voice conversation. And you're right. You're kind of stuck with a phone on a wall at that point, and everybody can listen. And it's different now where the texting can just go back and forth.
And you can just leave the house.
Absolutely.
And if you have a phone, you can find out what's going on, who's going to be where.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure as a parent, when you say, where are you going? Well, I haven't decided yet. We're going to make plans on the fly. Isn't that kind of the way it works?
Yeah, that really is. And to that point, we do end up, all of our kids know that phones are open access for us. And it's that question of, as parents, are we invading their privacy? But these days, I think it's really important that we err more on the side of what it is that our kids are up to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of things can be prevented because of that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then what does it teach us about maybe developing thicker skin when you actually have to walk up to somebody and ask them out or call them? And, you know, there's that rejection factor, which when that happens, of course, parents don't want their kids to be rejected ever, but that's just not life.
It's not life. And it's a cliche, but it's true that I think we tend to learn a lot more through failure and through difficulty in life than we do when everything is going great. And so the idea of learning to deal with that sort of rejection, as hard as that is, and I know last hour you were talking about having to use puppets back and forth these days in order to even deal with anything that seems like it's difficult, and as opposed to, can't we just work this through as human beings and recognize it's difficult, but what can we learn from, you know, from that experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whenever you bring puppets up, it always shuts me down.
Yeah, I've got nothing more to say. Now I'm just thinking puppets, and if Rebecca can bring them out again, that'd be incredible.
Yeah, but there's a socialization process that happens in life, which is pretty important, just introducing yourself to people. Let's just say you want to go get a job.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have to figure out a way to communicate with adults. And if you deal with a little rejection, don't you want it to happen when your kids are under the umbrella of your home, as you can help speak truth and build character into their life?
Yeah.
Versus the first time they get rejected is when they're out of the house at college or something.
Scary. Exactly. If you've never dealt with that piece of it, and I get it. I mean, there were so many disturbing headlines for a while around bullying, both in real physical space and, of course, now cyberbullying. And I think there's a lot of pendulum swing resistance to the cyberbullying. But has it gone so far that we don't learn just how to deal with social relationships to a way that we're going to disappoint each other? It's not always going to be easy. And the question becomes is, how can I keep myself in the game without just withdrawing because I get hurt on a given day? Granted, it often goes way too far, but we're just talking about normal life to some extent. And do we have to avoid all of this, or what can we learn from it?
Yeah. Now, Peter, one of the great joys of college life is the simple community aspect of being in college and being around people and having that constant fellowship. Now, online education, very necessary, very important. But talk about your experience doing that.
Yeah, it's fresh on my mind, actually, Bill, because about this time of the year, I get my course load for next year. And I think I'm somewhere in the neighborhood.
Wait, you still got the job next year?
Believe it or not, I do. I've dealt with rejection in my life, okay. Bill. I worked through it. So,
all right, just checking.
Yeah, indeed. And I think I have somewhere in the neighborhood of 13 to 15 classes that I'll be teaching next year, and half or more of them now are online. And that wasn't true even 5 years ago. And it's such a different experience. One of the things that I'm noting is that the campuses aren't anywhere near as full or as vibrant, especially during the weekends, because students are often taking online classes. They have jobs. They're feeling a lot of hassle and pressure.
Interesting.
And so they have to use the online tool in order to be able to get even education because they're so busy otherwise in life.
So how do you do that? You're in front of a green screen or something in your pajamas? How does that work?
I do. Yeah. I put on the bathrobe and just speak into the computer. It's a little awkward, actually, quite frankly.
I would think it would be.
It's so different than as opposed to teaching live, where you have to have some kind of interest or animation. And so much of teaching is just reading the faces in the room. For those teachers that are listening, they probably know that concept of what is to monitor and then adjust in your teaching, where in real time you have to monitor whether the content is landing, and you can kind of tell obviously when students begin to blank out, and so you can adjust on the spot and try to go at it from a different angle. You can't do that in an online deal. You do a 7 to 10 minute lecture and you have no idea how it's landing on students at that point, and it's really tricky.
I have to give you a lot of credit. I think that would be very hard.
Well, it's not what I signed up for. I will say
that.
You know, when you're a professor, you sign up to be in the classroom and active engagement with the students. And I do understand the necessity of it. And yet it's a really tricky tool in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Peter, let me take a break. When we come back, more with Dr. Peter Kapsner in just a minute. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Minutes after the hour. Welcome back to the show. Peter Kapsner is in studio. He's my Thursday regular guest. I always look forward to talking to Peter. And coming up in the next half hour, John Bloom is already in the green room, so he's fidgeting nervously, I can see. And we're going to do the McArnold Group, which is an unscripted, unrehearsed time together.
It's so fun to have John in like that.
I think we're going to try to live stream it on Facebook.
We are?
Yeah, I think we're going to.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, not today. Not today.
Oh, just
nobody
at some
told
point.
Me this.
What? No. Don't worry, Rebecca.
Okay.
Don't worry.
Fire
don't.
It up, Rebecca.
All right.
But I think it'd be kind of fun. You know, maybe or maybe not.
I think it'd be great to have a shot to take a look at it like that.
Yeah, because I guess people like that. I don't know why.
Well, Facebook is what I understand. It's a technological tool that connects us, Bill. I haven't seen much of it, but I do, you know, it feels like it would be really relevant if we got on Facebook.
So, Bill Cosby, he's got his fate with the jury right now, and this is round two. And do you think America's Dad is going to go to prison, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, usually when it goes to round two on some level, right, they're going to probably find something the second time around. It's hard to say, but it's sad. It was before all of this went down. We had such fun with our two oldest, Caleb and Anna, watching The Cosby Show, and we could just get onto Netflix and watch all 7, 8, 9 seasons. And they laughed as hard as
That's
we did
stuff.
When it first came on the air. I remember this is, of course, prior to the TiVo box deal where you could just record it or watch it at your convenience on Netflix or whatever. But I remember panicking with my father in the car at about 6:55 on a Thursday night saying, Dad, we got to get home. The Cosby Show has started. You get one shot to watch it in a given week, and you had to follow what the family was up to with Denise and Rudy and Theo and all of that.
Right.
It was brilliant. We love that show.
Yeah. And apparently one of the lawyers fell asleep during testimony. So,
really?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, that amount of power, when you think of to have that much power.
Yeah.
And boy, talk about opportunities for distortion, for sin, for all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's a scary amount of power to have.
You know, it really is when it's unchecked like that.
Yes.
And I don't think it's just the headlines where we pick out the ones that are hard. I think there's so much that's been going on relative to power in our culture. We're all it feels like we seek it and desire it without understanding the corrupting influence it can have when we begin to wield it. And so that's where we were just talking in a different context. I think it was one of my classes about the fact that in Jesus's kingdom, you end up giving up your power on behalf of others. I love that passage in Philippians where it says that though he was in very nature God, he didn't consider his power or equality with God something to be hung on to. Rather, he let it all go. So if you ever want to compare and contrast the kingdoms of this world with the kingdom of Jesus, you could start with the conversation on power mm-hmm. and what it means to give up the power that we have for the sake of the other versus wielding the power that we have in order to destroy or extort or come against the other. Those mm-hmm. are that's probably the single biggest contrast in the kingdoms of this world versus the kingdom of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Peter, you're going to France next week.
I am going to France
cool
next
is
week.
That?
Yeah.
I always love what Steve Martin said. He's mad at the French. They have a different word for every one of our words.
That's so, my 10-year-old Abby has been, she's been ripping me lately because all of my kids have been learning French in the homeschool growing up, and I'm the only one in her family that, other than croissant, I don't know a single French
yeah,
word
right.
at all, which is going to be helpful in the bakeries there. But she is saying, Dad, you got to learn some French, and I'm just going to be really curious when we get over there. I have a feeling I'm going to be completely dependent on my kids and my wife to lead the way on these things, but very excited to go. We have a week in Paris, and then we're going to go to the north of France and visit the beaches of Normandy and some of those experiences that I'm looking forward to. Yeah, I know, Bill. It's tough life being a college prof like this.
Yeah,
you know,
it's really
difficult. So.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure the last time a week in Paris came out of my mouth.
Yeah.
I don't think ever.
Well, again, when we talk about the kingdom of Jesus like we did before, suffering is such a part of that too.
It
so
is.
I'm willing to demonstrate that in the next couple of weeks. It's
mm-hmm.
it's going to be tough not knowing those French words. I'm going to have
yeah.
to work through that.
And your parents are going as well?
They are. It was part of the gift is
nice.
That with Caleb graduating this year, where they said we would take you on a trip to France to try out all the French you've learned growing up like this.
So. Uh-huh. So any little preview as to what's coming up in the McArnell Group?
Well, it sure appears that John's going to be in here shortly. We're
he
going to
is.
Talk a little bit about what it means
he's
to...
He's in the green room right now clipping his toenails.
He is. I know. Yeah. I'm glad he's doing it now as opposed to in studio like normal. But why you have a thorn in the flesh, I think, is going to be an interesting conversation.
Everybody has one.
To some degree,
don't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think... we always kind of think we've got to get rid of it. We've got to get rid of it. And I understand that part of it. But there is a different invitation in that thorn as well.
Do we want to get rid of it so we no longer have to be dependent on God?
I think that's absolutely true, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't
that what we always want to do is somehow maintain our autonomy and have some place where we feel like we aren't so desperate? But that's not at all how God designed us.
Yeah,
He wants us the opposite. He wants us to be desperately holding on.
I think that's it. I think I would, if when I pray a prayer of change of some kind, if I want to see a change happen in my life, and then I get confused or really upset that God doesn't just magically poof
mm-hmm,
it away
yep.
as if he's a genie in the bottle, I've wrestled with that over the years as to why that might be. And I began to recognize that it's probably a greater invitation to just what you described,
mm-hmm.
which is that dependence that I often don't have.
Yeah. When the guy goes to his neighbor and pounds on the door and wakes him and his family up because he needs bread for a friend who's coming over.
Yeah.
Is that a model for how we're supposed to petition God? Are we supposed to go to him persistently and go to him almost inconveniently?
Right.
I mean, how are we supposed to... Aren't we supposed to go to God that way?
Well, I think so.
Isn't he inviting us to do that?
I think so. And like I said, I sometimes think that God is... Obviously, God is concerned with our behavior. It's not about that. But I think God knows something deeper about us, that if God can get our heart... then the behavior is going to naturally flow from there. And I know if we served a God that was just sort of the behavior modification God who
right.
kind of just disciplined us when we screwed up a bit, as opposed to the God who invites us to walk in brokenness and dependence and humility. And from those places, we begin to treat each other very differently, as opposed to just trying to keep our behavior under control, which is usually my first concern is I've got to get this behavior, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
under control. So God, get it under control. And every once in a while you hear that still small voice that says, Peter, I'm actually after your heart
yeah.
on this one. And if I get your heart, we're not going to worry about all that other stuff because it's all going to shift.
Cool. All right. We're going to bring John Bloom in and have the McArnell Group in just a minute. We're going to take a break, though, for now. We'll go to Breakpoint with John Stone Street and then some news. We have a great rest of the hour planned, so stay tuned. Be back in a minute. It's 31 minutes after the hour. The McArnell Group is already conjoined together, so we're going to take a break for news. And then we are going to have a very lively discussion with John Bloom and Dr. Peter Kapsner. Be back in a minute.
Live from the Twin Cities, it's the McArnold Group, a totally unrehearsed discussion about important issues. It's that unrehearsed part that has the Faith Radio management uneasy. And now, here's your moderator, Bill McArnold.
Welcome to the McArnold Group, the feistiest collection of misfits on morning radio. We promise no screaming or interrupting each other unless it would
never,
help.
Never, Bill. We'll never do that.
Unless
never.
It would help ratings. Issue number two. What happened to issue number one? Pete Kefner.
I think we just covered it off air, I believe, and it was not sure what it was about, actually.
I have in the studio John Bloom and Pete Kefner. We are the McArnold Group. We have a lively conversation every once in a while. We want to talk about what people are having in going on in their life right now. What are they living with? What are they struggling with?
Well, I love the article, John. We referenced it in the first half of the show, too, just about that idea of a thorn in the flesh and what that means. It feels like I might have even more than one at any given moment. And so the reference obviously comes from Scripture when Paul was describing about how he really asked God over and over again to remove this thorn in the flesh. But I don't think, and that was part of what we talked about off air, I don't know that any of us really know what that thorn was. But what are some thoughts that you know, John, relative to that thorn?
Well, the first thought that I have is that it's a great blessing to us that none of us knows exactly what it was. So Paul references this thorn in the flesh in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. And it's one of the most famous afflictions in history, and we know nothing about
That's
it.
True.
We don't know anything about it. We don't know what it was. And that is a display of God's wisdom, because God is as wise in what he explicitly says in Scripture. Let me turn it around. He's as wise in what he does not explicitly say in Scripture as he is in what he explicitly does say. He has purposes in not saying certain things, and this is one of those things he doesn't say. And the reason why it's wise is because all of us can identify with Paul in his thorn, even though we may not have exactly what he experienced. So that's the first thing that comes to mind.
So what are some of the theories about what might he? So there is some wisdom in that, because I would say if we knew what the thorn was, then maybe we wouldn't consider what our thorns might be, because we would just say, I don't have that one. But what are some of the potential considerations that may connect even with our lives today?
Well, obviously, it could have been a physical affliction. We know in Galatians 4, Paul refers to something going on with his eyes. And so some people have speculated it could have been some eye issue that he had. We also know, because of what he's described in chapter 11 as well as chapter 12 in 2 Corinthians, that his life was full of physical afflictions. He had been beaten. He had been whipped. You know, he had been shipwrecked. I mean, his body at this time of his life would have been a wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could have been any number of physical afflictions. It could have been what we might categorize as a spiritual / psychological struggle. I mean, this man experienced all sorts of trauma. He started off as a persecutor of the church, and then he became very much persecuted. And he would have been, as a forerunner frontier missionary, under the attack of the evil one almost constantly. So there are all sorts of things that could have been going on there. And then the third thing it could have been is he had these people that were dogging him all over wherever he went. He called them the super apostles, and they were going around coming behind him to the churches that he had planted and discrediting everything he was doing and telling everybody what a jerk he was and how they shouldn't trust him and trying to destroy his work. And what we know is he calls that affliction a messenger of Satan. So he recognizes it's something, it's oppositional, it's very painful. And so could have been any one of those or something else.
Yeah, I mean, none of that connects with life, really, you know, right, in terms of the potential of physical maladies. I think we all experience that, too. The idea of just trauma, psychological, spiritual kinds of things that have happened in our lives that seem to keep pricking us, sort of. They rise to the surface again, and we get hit with it again, and we wonder, why am I not healed from that? Why does that stay there? Two, just experiences in life that are difficult, where people might gossip about us. It's going to be along the lines of those super apostles, as we're just trying to do our life, and there's people that are deconstructing sort of what we're doing. So this does really connect. What's the invitation to us in this when we experience these thorns in the flesh? What do we learn from Paul about how he navigated that thorn, and what did he learn from it?
Okay, so then we need to jump into the deep end of the theological pool here, because here's how Paul navigates his thorn in the flesh. He says that he was given this thorn, and we know by the context when you read 2 Corinthians 12, we know he's talking about God gave it to him. God gave him this thorn. And the reason we know that is because he says that the purpose that God had for him was for him to remain humble. He had been given a tremendous amount of revelations, so he's given this severe thorn to keep him humble so that he would not rely on his own strength but rely on God's strength. Okay, so it was given by God. And then he turns around in the same sentence and says it was a messenger of Satan. Okay, so what are you saying, Paul? You're given this thorn by God, and a messenger of Satan is the deliverer. Right there, I'm sure that a number of people are going, whoa, 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 whoa. You can't have two. It's either one or the other. And Paul does not have a problem with it. In fact, he doesn't even qualify it. He doesn't even explain it. He expects his readers to understand this because Paul knows his Bible like the back of his hand. His Bible would have been the Old Testament at the time, and he knew it. He knew, like, from Genesis 50, when Joseph says to his brothers, you meant evil against me. You meant it for evil, this whole sending me to Egypt and then getting in prison and whatever. But God meant it for good. So we can experience spiritual attack. We can, in things that are in themselves evils, that in God's providence he grants for our faith, that we might depend on him in ways that we would never depend on him otherwise.
Those are hard concepts. So you do think about when Satan sort of waltzes into the courts of heaven in the book of Job, and God allows him to do some of that work.
That's right.
We see it where evil spirits are sent by God towards Saul when Saul is sort of a disaster. What can we say, John? Just obviously the spiritual realm is such a huge conversation, but are these things still going on today, do you think? I mean, it doesn't seem to connect with me in 21st century America that there would still be this spiritual realm of angels and demons. And how do we begin to even think about this idea without going to those places of where it feels like we're a little whacked out and Satan's behind every bush or something? What's a good balanced approach to the realm of the spirit around us these days?
Well, if we get whacked out by the spiritual realm, we basically have to throw away most of the Bible. I mean, the biblical writers refer to it frequently.
They do.
And we live in this post-Enlightenment culture that so highly values human rationalism and has been so influenced by materialism in the philosophical, scientific sense that the air that we breathe we don't talk about that. Where other cultures in the world currently still do. And the past cultures, it was just part of life. They knew that the supernatural existed, and they were interacting with the supernatural all the time. And so one of the ways that we have to deal with this is we've got to get our heads into our Bibles. Because if we're not breathing biblical air, we will be breathing 21st century air, and that air is going to be highly biased in so many damaging ways to our worldview. We will miss things completely if we just live by that.
John, it says in Matthew 25:15 that he gave talents to each according to his ability. I'd like a little explanation on that. And how do we determine our talents? Do we declare what they are, or do we learn from people telling us?
Talents. Okay, so I think we have to decide what those things are. What did Jesus mean? You know, you're drawing from the parable of the talents.
Mm-hmm.
And all of Jesus' original readers would have understood what a talent was. A talent was this large unit of monetary value, okay? So it was a lot of money. And it's hard to draw any kind of modern correlation financially, but some scholars would say that a talent could have been worth in buying power somewhere in the realm of $600,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wow.
So it was something that was very valuable. But the readers also would have understood that Jesus was saying, using the talent metaphorically. So a talent is something that the master entrusts to his servants, something of high value that the servants are meant to invest. And the context of Jesus' parable is these are abilities that were given, And they can be inborn abilities, maybe natural abilities that we're born with. They can be things that we're entrusted with, you know, through the process of education, through all sorts of things. They're meant to be broad. They're not necessarily meant to be, you know, just like the spiritual gift inventories that we might be familiar with. They're meant to be broad. They're things that God has given to us. They could be abilities. They can be opportunities, and they're meant to invest well. Use them to invest well.
I like it. We need to take a break. When we come back, more with the McArnold Group. If you want to hear and read more about John Bloom's, go to desiringgod.org. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to the McArnold Group. 12 minutes until the top of the hour. Pete Kapsner, John Bloom in studio. All right. We, during the break, we're fighting over the last bear claw. P.S. I won. And also, I want to ask John about an important tie-in that you'd mentioned during the break and maybe pull those two together.
Yeah, actually, it was Rebecca, our producer, right?
She started it.
Yeah, she's the one who made the tie-in. And I think it's really important because you brought up the issue of talents.
Mm-hmm.
So talents tend to be things that we consider to be strengths, things that we're bringing to the table, things that God entrusts us with. And before then we were talking about how Paul was afflicted with a thorn, and the reason he was afflicted with the thorn was so that he would keep him humble. Why? Because he was entrusted with these huge, we could call them talents under Jesus' parabolic structure there. We call them talents. He was given talents to invest. Now, these talents were of such a nature that if he wasn't careful, if he wasn't kept humble, they would be infected by his pride and he could abuse them and bring huge amounts of destruction into churches. And so he was given a thorn in the flesh to keep. Why? Why was he given that? To keep him humble so that he could rather boast in his weaknesses, because when I am weak, then I am strong. Why? Because then he is dependent upon the strength of God to be able to use his strengths well. He knows he's nothing on his own. And I just think that was a really, really valuable tie-in between the thorn and talents.
I like it.
And is it possible, John, just when you were going back to that idea of this sort of difficult theological question, sometimes it appears God even does more than allow, but even sends some of these messengers of Satan to do this work of affliction. Is it possible that God is strategically breaking us and allowing that to happen so that we actually can become stronger in the kingdom? And so this idea of a spiritual attack actually brings great strength to our lives at the end of the day.
Well, that's exactly what Paul says. Paul says, when I am weak, then I am strong. Now, that just sounds crazy. That's a crazy statement. What do you mean when you are weak, then you are strong? Well, it's because when I know I am weak, then I rest on the strength of God. Or I work, as Peter would say it, the Apostle Peter, not to mistake.
Oh, I thought it was me for a second. I was so excited, John.
That I work in the strength that God supplies. All right. So that's why Paul was given that thorn. He recognized it to keep him humble, that he may serve in the strength that God supplies so that in everything God may get glory. So that is why we are given thorns. Now we might have great complaints against God for the thorns. And we, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, and we're not, you know, this is a big complex issue. But if anything that causes us to throw ourselves completely on God and learn how to depend on him and learn how to really pray and learn how to really seek him and learn how not to trust our own perceptions, but trust his promises, all those, whether they're sent from Satan or not, become great gifts for us.
It makes me think about Jesus' very first words in his very first sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, where the first invitation he gives when he says, blessed are those who are poor in spirit, or blessed are those who know they don't have what it takes. For when we come to that posture in life, then we receive the kingdom, or that is the entryway into the kingdom, is through brokenness and through a bent knee and a recognition that we don't have what it takes. And that's so countercultural, where we are always sort of trying to prop ourselves up and make our own ways forward. But the invitation of the kingdom is to recognize, hey, I don't actually have what it takes. And I can say that, But it's until actually something in life or something going on actually really breaks me that then the kingdom begins to unfold.
Yeah, it's not only countercultural, it's just counter-natural humanity.
Yeah.
It's always been countercultural. Nobody wants to be weak in those ways. Everybody wants to be strong, and everybody wants to be impressive, and everybody wants to be admired, and everybody wants to conquer, and everybody wants to whatever. And what we often don't realize is how desperately, desperately we need to live by faith in the Son of God who loved us and gave himself up for us. What does it mean to live by faith? It means being dependent on him in ways that We trust in him for our all. And anything that helps us understand what that means and actually live it is a priceless gift. And it often comes in the package of suffering.
And that's not a real popular invitation. I mean, what fills our churches and culture today is the idea that if I just trust God, I will sort of get the things that I want, that I will then get the spouse that I'm looking for, I'll get the pets that I want, I'll get the money that I need, I'll get the job that I desire, that we almost treat God like a vending machine at times where we put our quarter of faith in and expect him to dispense what it is that we're asking for. But you're talking about a very different kind of journey in the Christian faith.
Yeah. That's why if we want to know how faith operates, that's why we go to Hebrews 11 and read the lives of those biblical saints. What were they like?
Let me ask you this, John. I hear that when I'm weak, then I am strong. And I know there's people listening on their way to a job that they probably feel burned out over. Maybe it's something that they do day in and day out, and they're caregiving or something, and they're just so burnt. And then the person will come along and say, well, that's because you're using your strength. You need to stop using your strength and use God's. Now, maybe that's true, but it doesn't sound very nice.
Well, you know, I think probably all of us, to some degree or another, we have this knee-jerk response to almost anything we do, whether it's in something that's burning us out or something that we're really jazzed about and really excited about, mm-hmm. is to labor in our own strength. That's self-sufficiency. Mm-hmm. And all of us require the gracious, redemptive discipline of the Lord to teach us not to do that, right? So Hebrews 12, we were just talking about Hebrews 11. So Hebrews 12 is about the discipline of the Lord. That's what that's about, is to teach us that. Now, when we're talking about having to endure some long extended season of difficulty, I'm not quick to call that anything in particular. You know, but all I know from reading my Bible is that is not uncommon. That is a common human experience. And when we are enduring those seasons, they are, there can be, God is doing 10,000 things in whatever he's doing in us, you know, whatever circumstances, not just one thing. But one thing we know that he's doing in us is working in us a desperation for him and a sense of deep need. And unless you come and do something, God, I'm not going to make it. That experience does not mean you're outside the will of God. That may mean exactly what that season is all about. That's where the hope can come in, is if you can get to the place of desperation and where you are crying out to him day and night, that may be precisely the means of grace that you need, that God is working in you. That would be one thing I would say.
Profound. Do seminaries apply to you? Do seminaries apply to you?
No.
It's great stuff, John. It's some of those things I think it's, you know, and I love your writing. You know, I mentioned it to you off air that I love on the Desire in God or Excite, just that you're willing to dive into the biblical text in ways that really can pull out some of these deep but incredibly applicable and important things for our Christian journey. I think there's a lot of wisdom in this idea that we've talked about today of brokenness and what it means to start out our journey in the kingdom. So I appreciate all of what you pull out of the text in this way.
Thank you, Peter.
All right. That wraps up yet another edition of the McArnold Group. Thanks so much. We'll take a short break and wrap up the show. All right. That wraps up the show. Thank you to John Bloom for coming in studio. Dr. Peter Kapsner, always a pleasure. We're thinking about adding Rebecca Maxwell to the McArnold Group. What do you think about that, Rebecca?
Only if I can be called Eleanor Clift.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to do that. Trust me, that would be great. So that wraps up the show. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting Faith Radio. I'm still a little gushy over spring share that happened in last winter. But, you know, that's the way it works in Minnesota. All right, that wraps up the show. Once again, I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.